The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, welcome to Pod Save the UK. This is a very special episode that we recorded on Wednesday, the 22nd of May, and a great conversation about the challenges facing the transgender community at the moment in this country. It was recorded before the election announcement, and that's why it's been released after we had a conversation about the general election. But we're so proud of this episode, so please listen and enjoy.
Hi, this is Pod Save the UK.
I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan.
This week, the government says schools should stop teaching children about gender identity.
We're joined by Freddie McConnell and Abigail Thorne.
And we call bullshit on the claim that students are being taught about 72 genders. Last week, the government announced new draft guidance for schools in England and Wales to not teach about, and I quote, the concept of gender identity. To explain what gender identity refers to, that's the personal sense of how we define our own gender. For some of us, that corresponds to the sex assigned at birth, and for others, it's something else. So essentially, regardless of your age, whether you're 17 or 7, the updated guidance is clear, gender identity shouldn't be taught.
The proposals came from Education Secretary Gillian Keegan, who says that schools should make it clear that gender ideology is a contested subject. That's her phrases, not ours. The document asks that schools do not use any materials that present those, quote, contested views as fact, and that includes the view that gender is a spectrum.
There is an exemption for schools to continue teaching children about people who undergo gender reassignment surgery, but Keegan clarifies that's because gender reassignment is a protected characteristic. And, I mean, the interesting thing here is around this subject, it does seem like the government is actually out of step with the country on this issue. A recent poll from YouGov suggests that 60% of Britons think that schools should teach people that people can be non-binary or identify as a gender other than male or female.
How can it be that you can talk about people who have undergone gender reassignment surgery, as rightly you should,
yeah,
but you can't talk about any of their journey before that?
Yeah.
And when you start thinking like that, you can't help but think of Section 28, right? Which was the Conservative government policy that we grew up under, which said that, you know, the promotion of homosexuality, again, quote, was banned. It was only repealed in 2003.
It was a policy from the Margaret Thatcher era, and the Labour MP and a former guest on the show, Nadia Whittome, has criticised the government's decision and made specific reference to this. She said the Tories' claims about what children are learning are designed to fuel hysteria and build support for Section 28-style policies, which is what this latest guidance seems to be harking back to. We actually had a comment in from a listener, Law Wilson, talking about the effect of Section 28 on their life. And this is what Law had to say. In my early to mid-30s, I was finally able to embrace my genderqueerness, but I know that much pain and suffering would have been alleviated for me had I had more information available to me earlier on and had I grown up in a culture that was more accepting. Thanks very much for sharing that, Law. And it is heartbreaking, the idea that people were living unhappy lives for no real reason.
So one of the government's lines that has been repeatedly rolled out after announcing the shift in the guidance is that students are being taught that there are an oddly specific number of genders, and that number apparently is 72. Here's the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, appearing on ITV's Loose Women.
You know, we've got lots of people talking to kids. They were talking about you can have 72 different gender identities, or very young kids being exposed to things which clearly aren't appropriate. Now, I don't remember that being an issue when I was younger, but clearly that is now an increasing concern.
It's important to note that this 72 genders is a very specific number that's being trotted out. It's been on the front pages of tabloids. There's a Sun headline that says children need their innocence back, not to be taught about 72 genders. There's been op-eds written about 72 genders. Andrew Pearce raised the number on Good Morning Britain. But Where is the evidence that this is being taught to kids? Here is Gillian Keegan speaking to Charlie State on BBC Breakfast and trying to answer that question.
What's the evidence?
There have been materials which I've seen and I've had
Like what? Tell me what those are.
I was just about to, Charlie. I was just about to. So the evidence is things like, you know, choosing lots of different sort of genders and identities and saying which ones of these are gender identities, the spectrum, you know, the sort of, it can be a spectrum, it's fluid, you can have different genders on different days or different, there's 72 of them, that kind of thing. Yes, there has been evidence.
And that was taught by a teacher in a classroom.
We've received evidence with those slides to say that they've been taught in classrooms.
That was absolute soup.
Yeah, no, I know.
It was soup. She was just saying gender identity is gender identity is gender identity is 72 genders. The idea that that person is in charge of anything is frankly deeply terrifying.
So we don't really know where it's come from, this evidence that she's speaking about, and we've been trying to get to the bottom of it. It's all a bit inconclusive. So the most recent possible evidence of this claim comes from a report around a school on the Isle of Man. It said that a guest speaker had been invited to the school and when asked by a student how many genders there are, replied, oh, there might be as many as 72. But that initial report has turned out to be entirely false. So that is one theory.
And there's another alternative answer, and one that stretches all the way back to 2014, where in a diversity and inclusion effort, Facebook introduced a new system to self-identify one's own gender, expanding to a total of 71 different ways of describing it. But that's not exactly educational material that the government are claiming exists. At the moment, all we can seem to see is that this number has come from a report on the Isle of Man, which is also, just to be specific, not within England and Wales, but also that report turned out to be false anyway. So it is a very, very strange thing that this figure of 72 genders just keeps on being trotted out. And when they're asked to produce evidence, Gillian Keegan has a sort of word-based nervous breakdown about it.
Yeah, and I think it's worth mentioning that this has been going around the world. It's featured quite heavily in your profession, Nish, the stand-up comedy world.
Yes, there has been a very strange tradition of very, very high-profile, successful male comedians. I don't know why I'm talking around the subject. Dave Chappelle and Ricky Gervais doing jokes about this community. And there's a huge number of bad stand-ups doing jokes about how, oh, I identify as a chair or I identify as a monkey or whatever it is. And I really am struggling to understand why people in my profession are trying to drag us backwards. Because, you know, there was a lot of comedy in the United Kingdom and around the world that was very regressive and trades in unpleasant stereotypes. And I thought that we were trying to push comedy in a direction that moved beyond that. And, you know, these aren't marginalized voices. Mm. These aren't fringe figures. These are arguably the two most successful and powerful stand-ups in the world who are using the global platform given to them by their Netflix specials to target and attack a vulnerable and marginalized community. And I can't understand the logic of why they're doing it. It's been a very, very frustrating couple of years to be a comedian. I found it quite heartbreaking. As someone who always viewed comedy as a way of marginalized people kicking back at their oppressors, which is not to say that there isn't also brilliant comedy coming from that community. And, you know, Hannah Gadsby and Mae Martin are just two examples of people that have talked about these issues in a much more sensitive and interesting way. But yeah, it has been kind of gutting, you know, especially as somebody who grew up as like a huge fan of Chappelle and Gervais, to see the direction that they've gone in sucks, really.
It's like Morrissey, isn't it?
Oh my God, Morrissey. We don't even have time to get into Morrissey.
You basically don't like things, Nish. Don't like things because they will always let you down.
What happens when a prominent Indian judge seemingly dies of a heart attack, but his family doubts the official story?
Crooked Media and The Branch have teamed up for a brand new limited series, Killing Justice, where host Ravi Gupta follows the reporting and legal fallout from the controversy.
Throughout the 8 episodes, Ravi examines the conflicting evidence to answer how one man's death became a magnet for the increasingly polarised politics in India and what this means for the future of the world's largest democracy.
Listen to the Killing Justice trailer now on Apple or Spotify, and don't miss the 2-episode premiere on May 27th. For ad-free episodes, join the Friends of the Pod community at crooked.com/friends.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
It's a sad fact of the media that quite often communities that are spoken about are very rarely heard from themselves. That's something we aim to fix on this podcast, whether we're talking to people who have experienced the COVID inquiry or we're talking to care leavers. To this end, we're trying to make the world a little bit better by passing the mic to the trans community. With us today is Abigail Thorne, actor, writer and host of YouTube channel Philosophy Tube, and Freddie McConnell, a writer and journalist.
Before we have a conversation about what we're here to talk about, I want to just acknowledge that this is a big moment for our show because, Abigail, you are the first person who has been in Star Wars who has appeared on Podsafe the UK.
Oh.
This is a huge moment for me personally in the context of the show. So you're going to be on The Acolyte, which is coming out in June 4th.
Which is not long now.
Yeah, it's not long.
Right? Yeah.
Did you get a lightsaber?
I can't tell you that.
I can't. Are you NDA'd on the lightsaber?
I can't tell you anything about my character.
You can't tell anything about it?
No, I'm sorry. Oh.
Was it fun?
It was very, very fun. I had a great time. It was really, really good. And I was obviously very excited.
You're saying you're not NDA'd. There isn't an NDA saying you cannot say if this was a good experience or not.
I'm allowed to tell you that I had a great time. And everyone was lovely. Leslie Headland, who made the show, was super sweet to me. And everyone who worked on it was really nice and I had a great time.
Were you a Star Wars fan before?
I was, yeah. I've actually been watching it since I was very, very little.
Oh.
So it was very, very exciting.
Freddie, are you a Star Wars fan?
Totally. I was obsessed as a kid and I had all the big toys and then I sold them all at one point. So there's got that kind of really bittersweet experience of doing that and now wishing I'd kept them, like the big AT-AT walker. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I've tried, my kids aren't really quite there yet. We've tried The Mandalorian, but that was definitely just for my benefit.
I know lots of people who've been watching The Mandalorian for their kids.
Yeah.
Their kids have absolutely no interest in it whatsoever. I believe you're the first person who's been in Star Wars. It is going to be funny if it turns out George Monbiot was in Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
But as far as
George
we know...
George Monbiot, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, really tried to make that work, but not quite.
Monbiot, Obi-Wan. He has a... Kenobi-ish vibe.
He definitely does. You could imagine him appearing on the hillside with a long cloak on. Yeah.
So turning to the subject of today's conversation, I just want to start with access to healthcare for the trans community. And let's start by clarifying a term used by the NHS, which is gender dysphoria. That's used to describe, and this is their language, the sense of unease between one's biological sex and gender identity. I know, Abigail, you've spoken before about that term being used to segregate care. I wondered if you could just expand on that.
Just so much in that NHS. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah, it is hard to know where to start.
I'm going to get in, like, just even the way that they have reified the concept of biological sex as if like that's an objective fact that's like discovered and not something which is assigned. Like a lot of people are still like, oh, like, well, you can't change sex, but you can change your gender. It's like, no, actually, you clearly you can. Yeah. I have. But there's just so much going on there. I'm going to get in so much trouble for this. In my opinion, gender dysphoria is a term that was invented by cis people to pathologize certain desires, pains, and expressions of bodily autonomy that patriarchy finds inconvenient. This was put across in the medical literature at the time when it was coined a few years ago, when it was coined by the American Psychiatric Association out of some very limited and flawed data. The feelings that it describes, the pains and the desires and the wishes that it describes are real. However, in my opinion, I believe that putting a clinical label on it, as the NHS does, but only when trans people have it, is basically a way of saying, this is the thing that trans people have, and this is the thing that justifies us taking control of their bodies away from them. Mm. That's why I think it's a pathologizing term.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely a way of saying that we've depathologized, or, you know, the saying that, you know, being trans isn't an illness. But this is, it's a stand-in for that, basically. So not really doing what we said we've done. And I agree about the whole, like, I understand why trans people in particular talk about sex and gender as two separate things in order to try and help cis people understand our experiences, but I actually think it's incredibly unhelpful and inaccurate. It's separate for trans people, apparently, as a useful way of describing our experiences, but like everyone else gets to completely kind of merge and blend and not ever separate the two.
You say like useful, and I think the question is in quotes, useful to who? And, and the answer has been, it's been very useful to the medical establishment who do not allow us to control our own bodies.
Yeah.
But whether it's useful for allowing anyone, cis or trans, to understand themselves, I don't think it is.
Mm.
Waiting times are a big part of access here. So you've both spoken about the length of time people wait for a first appointment at a gender identity clinic. The NHS aims to see all non-urgent referrals from a GP within 18 weeks. But the BBC has reported that in England between 2018 and 2023, that waiting time at least doubled. Patients seen for the first time in November 2023 were said to wait an average of 7 years and 3 months. And estimates from March of this year suggest that it would take 10 years to clear the backlog.
Those numbers are really shocking, aren't
That's
they?
That's an underreport. I was told 26.
Really?
If you sort of look at it, keep on going up exponentially over time, yeah, and it sort of ends up in that kind of realm. Wow. I mean, it just means that you cannot get on with your life, in very broad terms, I suppose. That's
sometimes
how it felt
literally.
For me. Yeah, sometimes literally in terms of not being able to leave the house and, you know, not being able to just do daily tasks. And, I mean, I didn't get my first job until I was on my way with my transition, and I don't think I could have had I not been, you know, and that was the start of my career. Obviously, I'm just one person, that's anecdotal, but it's huge. But I think it also needs to be seen in the context of like the politics and the conversation in this country. It's not like you're waiting and everyone's saying, oh God, it must be so hard, and oh, we're doing everything we can. You know, you're waiting and you know that it's for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not only sort of very depressing, but incredibly angering and, you know, yeah, I think that's the most important thing to focus on.
The impact is Alice Lipman. The impact is Sophie Williams, Jason Putnam, Charlie Millers, Armani Lewis Daniel. The impact is a growing pile of coroner's reports saying that the NHS has failed to provide gender-affirming care in a timely manner, and this has contributed to the deaths of patients. Mm. And all the while, the NHS managers who've been told since at least 2013 in multiple reports and consultations and reviews that they need to desegregate the system and implement an informed consent system which would save money and lives and eliminate the waiting list. All the while, the managers who've deliberately chosen not to do that are not only still walking free, but still being paid.
You mentioned the word desegregate there. What would that look like?
It would look like us getting the same healthcare that cis people get, the same way that cis people get it. So right now, if a cisgender woman goes through menopause and experiences anxiety and depression and goes to her doctor and says, hey, I want hormone replacement therapy, I want some estrogen, she can get it from her GP. If a trans woman experiences the same states of mind and goes to the same doctor and requests the same medication, she has to go to a segregated gender identity clinic with a 10 or 26 year wait, be diagnosed with this thing, gender dysphoria, and jump through all the hoops before she can get the exact same medicine from that GP. That's what we mean by segregation, and that's what we should be eliminating.
On top of that, the Royal College of GPs has just been advising GPs to stop doing that kind of joined up care with gender identity clinics, basically saying to GPs, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do blood tests, you don't have to prescribe hormones, you don't have to do any of that. This is not in the role of the GP. Obviously, someone has gotten into that, the Royal College of GPs, and, you know, something's happened there. Institutional capture, I know, is a term that's bandied around too often at the moment, but it's getting worse in ways that I don't think are even sort of reaching the media. Mm. Day by day.
I can speak to that, actually. Just over a month ago, the Royal College of GP hosted a conference of conversion therapists. They were warned that that was what it was, and they did it anyway. When I was investigating why the NHS is the way it is, when they initially refused to treat me, I actually spoke to a senior member of the Royal College of GPs. They issued a statement in 2019, now updated, in which they said, as you described, Freddie, that it's not within the role of the GP to assist trans patients, basically, despite the fact that WPATH's guidance, the international best practices for treating trans patients, say that we should be treated in primary care. The Royal College still maintains that absolutely not. They just ignore that guidance. And in fact, they don't even mention it. When I spoke to a senior member of the college, he told me there is a small C conservative attitude towards trans people in the college and that decisions are made on the basis of politics rather than medical evidence. His words.
There we go.
And that's obviously that's being exacerbated on a week to week basis as the Conservative Party ratchets up the language here, right? There is a clear line that can be drawn between, Rishi Sunak's kind of almost like weekly outburst on the subject and the treatment of people in their day to day lives, right? Politics is not remote in this instance.
Oh, no, at all. I mean, when Steve Barclay was Health Secretary, it happened. You could see it happening a lot. You know, they went after the rainbow badge scheme in the NHS. It's not just trans people, actually, within the NHS. You speak to people who work in NHS England. I've got friends who have been within that organisation who have just left. It's too much. They can't carry on. Their work is frustrated at every turn. Yeah, it's definitely a sort of chilling effect on LGBTQ people in general and our healthcare, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's partly a political thing. Partly these problems predate the Conservative government by quite a long way, and I've actually been present in the NHS for a long time. I mean, it's not really that long ago that the NHS was openly practicing conversion therapy instead of, as I believe they're doing now, covertly practicing it in many cases. I think what it comes down to is that there are some people within the NHS who want to hurt us and there are some who want to help us. What most of them actually share, though, is a belief deep down, perhaps even so deep they don't realise it, but they really do believe that they have the moral authority to decide for a trans person when, how, and whether we may transition. I think a lot of them really do believe that, no, it's morally okay for them to decide that for us. And that, I think, is the key cognitive shift that we need to be making within the NHS is to say to these senior managers, look, you should not have this authority. You should never have had this authority. The fact that you have wielded it and defended it for so long has led to deaths.
It's really good to hear you say that, you know, this predates the Conservative government. It felt like when the Scottish government were looking at the GRA, the Gender Recognition Act, and changes to that, that suddenly it went into the media. And I think it was really good that you just sort of said, no, be clear here. It was crap then as well.
We've never had an NHS that allows trans people to control our own lives.
And what happened when, you know, like you say, sort of 6-7 years ago, everything just exploded into the media. That was because of attempts to try to update the system. But when Theresa May sort of waded in quite ignorantly, not really aware of what she was getting herself into, and said, oh, we're going to do this, it's going to be fine, it's going to be, you know, no big deal. That's when people kind of latched onto that and it became this, you know, incredible attack and backlash. You know, that's what happens when you try and sort of update the system, I suppose. That's really scary. But it's also been a perfect storm of that, plus this kind of, you know, increasingly right-wing conservative government. I think we need to be more specific about who we're talking about. There are people in the government who don't really care about us, and I would probably put Sunak in that camp. You know, if you look at the British Attitude surveys over many years, the majority of Brits just either sort of are in favour of trans equality or like just could not care less. Whereas people like Kenny Badenoch are ideologically fervently opposed to our existence and recognition in public life. And I'd say there's evidence that this is her personal campaign behind the scenes, because it comes up, just keeps popping up in different places. And I'm sure there are other ministers, other people in government involved. But I heard the story the other day where she was saying that cis girls in schools were getting UTIs because they were afraid to go to the toilet. Didn't provide any evidence for that. She just said it and it got reported. Like, you know, she can just say that and then, you know, include some stuff, other stuff about trans people being kind of whatever, threatening. I shared that story on my Instagram and within an hour I had messages from two parents saying that their trans sons actually did have UTIs because they weren't using the toilet at school. That's the reality that I get in my inbox and people are kind of just living with, and meanwhile she gets to go and sort of say this and get headlines and not have to provide any evidence that that is actually happening.
We just listened to Gillian Keegan be asked about this claim about children being taught about 72 genders and being asked by the host on BBC Breakfast what the evidence for that was, and there was just none. She sort of repeated the words gender identity. It was a bizarre sort of like a performance art piece about somebody like trying to fill the air when they don't have anything to actually to say. We also talked earlier about the government's draft guidance for schools to avoid the discussion of gender identity. Is that the sort of logical result of this kind of the ideologues like Kemi Badenoch within the Conservative Party?
Yeah, they have incredibly effectively euphemised all of this so that they can talk about it in ways that we recognise as very, very worrying and alarming and bigoted, but to sort of your average listener sound much more reasonable. So they'll never talk about trans people. They don't say the word trans. They don't talk about adults. They just talk about children. It's like classic fear-mongering, moral panic stuff. And they also talk about gender identity, but they mean trans people. And obviously this, yeah, the recent announcement has been correctly identified by many of us as Section 28 all over again, where you couldn't talk about gay people in schools. And that, I mean, I don't think people realise that that is what is being talked about, and it is a failure of our media that they aren't recognising that and being more challenging on it.
Once you accept the premise that you can deny a certain group of people their bodily autonomy over transition, why not abortion? Why not contraception?
Yeah. Exactly.
Why not IVF?
This is incredibly personal for the PSHE thing, the guidance for schools. My eldest child is about to go, he's in year one, so he's got the kind of first year of where they actually talk about sort of not sex, but bodies, you know, in an incredibly age-appropriate, sensitive way. And I was going to go into the school to chat about how they're going to make sure that families like his are included, because I gave birth to him. I'm trans. I'm, you know, he's only got one parent because we use donor sperm and all this sort of stuff. And then like the next day that news landed of like, we're not going to teach kids about gender identity. Current guidance from the Department of Health says that children should not be made to feel stigmatized by their home situation. So it's actually really inclusive at the moment, and broad, you know, for teachers to interpret as they see fit. But yeah, now I have to sort of have in the back of my mind like, oh, but the, you know, we all know that the government is trying to stop schools from being able to sort of acknowledge from my six-year-old that his family exists and that his dad is trans and that trans people is and all of our friends. It's like, wow, it's really extreme. And I just, yeah, it's not often that it actually really hits home like that, I guess, because we're, you know, privileged in various ways and we're far along in our transition or whatever it is. But like, yeah, that's where we are now.
But it's also maddening because there's always this constant rolling moral panic about censorious behaviour in schools and students not being taught about certain bits of history because they're going to be triggered or whatever. And I know there's a certain futility in pointing out the hypocrisy of these people because they don't care about being hypocritical. But it is frustrating to listen to weeks and weeks of this generation can't take any information, that we should be teaching them about everything. Oh, not this thing.
One thing that wasn't around so much during Section 28 is the internet.
Yeah.
It's like kids have a smartphone now. They can see trans people. They can read the things that we write and see the things that we make. Like, if they like Star Wars, they're going to see me in it. Like, like, come on. Like, unless you're going to ban that, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, it does seem like it's going to be quite difficult for people to, like, blur you out of the acolyte.
It would be very funny to see Kemi Badenoch, and probably quite in keeping to see Kemi Badenoch come on the television and say, we must crush the Rebel Alliance. That'd be like, yeah, I'm not surprised, actually, yeah.
A couple of years ago, a cop was shot dead on a deserted pier in the tiny nation of Belize. The only other person there that night was a frightened young woman found covered in blood. By all appearances, it was an open and shut case. But not in Belize, where this woman was connected to a mysterious billionaire who basically runs the place.
Justice will not be served in this case. She's going to get away with it.
Or will she? White Devil, a Campside Media original. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Labour has made their own announcements this week on the process for gender recognition. So currently, for someone to have their gender affirmed legally, a panel of doctors and lawyers is convened to approve their gender recognition certificate. The Times has reported that Labour is seeking simplification of the process, possibly just requiring the approval of a GP for someone's gender to be legally reassigned. So the Shadow Women and Equalities Minister, Annalise Dodd, said, "We want to see the process for gender recognition modernised while protecting single-sex spaces for biological women. This means stripping out the futile and dehumanising parts of the process for obtaining a gender recognition certificate while retaining important safeguards." Is this the kind of action that you're looking to a government to do, or is it more frustrating to hear a statement like that that is filled with sort of caveats?
If a cis person doesn't need permission to get married in the right gender, I don't see why I should either. I certainly don't see why I should have to accept that kind of statement from somebody who continues to use transphobic phrases like the biological women instead of cis women.
Yeah.
Because, of course, we are biological. I don't know about
know.
You, Freddie, but I'm not
feel
a robot.
Pretty biological, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I'm not a robot or an alien, though I do play an alien on TV. Like,
hold on, is that ND8?
No, no, well, they're all aliens. It's a galaxy far, far away. Like, I'm allowed to say, like, yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely would rather they just shut the fuck up rather than come out with like half-baked ill-conceived. Like, why are they feeling the need to say that now? It's clearly just going to feed into, and they'll probably backtrack. In terms of policy and sort of reform of the law, that's not what trans people need. Like, self-ID, again, obviously has been completely weaponized. Yeah. It is, basically, self-ID is just self-determination, which is a fundamental right. Mm. And that is what we need. We don't need the state to be able to decide who we are. We can do that. You know, 20 plus countries now have these laws, and there's no evidence that it has any harmful impact on anyone. Germany is going to be the latest. Their mm-hmm. law is coming into effect in August this year. So no, I mean, that might sound to, again, sort of untrained ear, like relatively positive, but it's not. I'd say it's hurtful, harmful.
It's like politics of affect rather than of facts. When she uses words like protecting and like safeguarding and so on, that's, she's trying to get across this idea, oh, we're a safe pair of hands. But the thing that she's supposedly protecting us against is entirely phantasmic. As you say, there are like 20 countries that have self-ID now. Mm. There's no evidence that it causes any kind of threat to cis people. Anyone who legitimizes that claim or like publishes it in a newspaper is, as far as I'm concerned, spreading misinformation.
And as I understood it, and please do correct me if I have this wrong, but like really we're talking about self-ID. We're just talking about admin. We're talking about paperwork.
No, yeah.
Like,
yeah. There are so few things that a GRC, a gender recognition certificate, actually impacts.
Yes, yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah,
like, when was the last time you showed your birth certificate to enter a toilet? Never.
No. Never, exactly.
Yeah, it's, what is it? It's marriage,
death. And pensions.
Pensions and, well, possibly parenthood in a very complicated way.
Oh, yeah,
that
yeah. Of course,
now, but,
of course.
But that's one
yeah.
of the other things that they are kind of, the current government is trying to unpick. Yeah, so, you know, you can change your passport, your driving licence, any banks, whatever. It's sort of, I mean, even the name system in this country is really interesting. You can change your name by just saying you've changed your name. You don't even need a deed poll.
Mm. Right.
So I guess that's fine. That's, you know, like there are ways in which that could presumably be abused, but we don't get rid of it. We don't say we need to protect so-and-so group. You know, yeah, it's, I don't get it because the Conservative Party especially is meant to be in favour of like personal freedom and less interference from the state. And literally, this is what they are saying.
Speaking of interference, this is the same Kemi Badenoch who was caught writing secret letters to the Financial Conduct Authority asking them not to implement new trans-inclusive rules, which she's not supposed to do because the FCA is meant to be independent of her office.
Right.
Sometimes I don't know who's more dangerous in some ways, the kind of hardline ideologues or someone like Sunak still willing to weaponize and like mobilize against that community because he's trying to save his own political skin. And I don't know whether I don't know who I find sort of more dangerous. I mean, the ideologues need the spineless to facilitate them, I think, sometimes.
For sure. I just think being aware of what is going on behind the scenes, the kind of rabid efforts to desperately unpick our rights before they leave power.
Yeah.
At the moment, I would say, obviously, they are being facilitated by people who are more in the spotlight, but these people, what they're doing is absolutely terrifying. So I think that they are far more dangerous. We want to sort of bring them to the fore and say, look, these people, what are they doing? Where is the checks and balances? Or where is the, often it's just like the paper trail, like guidance gets updated in things like the law that controls sort of fertility treatment gets updated in a way to exclude trans people, or the Birth Death Registration Act or birth certificate stuff that gets updated to make it harder. Like, just happens. Nothing. There's no announcement. There's no accountability. This is happening day by day at the moment. And it is, I think people even now aren't aware of the extent of it.
Well, I do want to talk to you guys about the CAS review. It was an NHS England commissioned independent review of gender identity services for children and young people. It was commissioned in 2020 and it was released in April, so last month. Some of the findings of the CAS review were that there is no clear evidence that social transition in childhood has positive or negative mental health outcomes. It recommends a policy review into masculinizing or feminizing hormones with extreme caution for anyone from ages 16 to 18 and states that clinicians can't determine with any certainty which children and young people will go on to have an enduring trans identity. The review has not called for adolescents to have their right to their identity or autonomy removed, but Stonewall and the charity Mermaids are concerned that misrepresentations or misunderstandings around the findings from the report may be used to suppress young people's identities. Does that sound right to you?
No, because you used the word independent. And I think the very first thing we need to talk about when we mention the CAS review is that it deliberately excluded trans people from all of its governing boards. Several members of its advisory board have since been found to be known pro-conversion therapy activists, some of whom directly lobbied Kemi Badenoch against a ban, which immediately questions its independence. And some of the people on NHS England's working group on gender dysphoria have now been revealed to be members of pro-conversion therapy organisations too. So the first and immediate word I would challenge there is the word independent.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it sounds right in the sense that though that is what it says, but it's not genuine. I think I was reading the transactual briefing on it and it sort of just pointed out that saying something is independent does not make it independent.
It's quite similar to a lot of reports that we've seen come out under this government, like the Woolney report and the Sewell report as well, and that it exists to be cited rather than actually read. They've already decided what they're going to do, which is further restrict trans healthcare and ignore all the deaths that they've caused and never apologise or pay for it. And this is the document that they've created to point to and say, hey, we're doing what this says. And it was like independent and evidence-led, despite the fact that it's actually neither of those things.
We should say that the review states that gender questioning and trans people were included. And in the FAQs of the review, it states that it met with over 1,000 individuals and stakeholders, but prioritised two areas. So the first is people with relevant lived experience and organisations working with LGBTQ plus children and young people generally. And the second was it was clinicians and other relevant professionals. I do find the presence of even the fact that we're talking about conversion therapy at all, that feels very sinister. And not just sinister, but like it feels really retrograde. Like it feels so strange that we're even having to engage with the idea of, I thought conversion therapy was something that if for any community we'd left behind, you know, in the 20th century, like it feels...
Oh, it's back, baby.
But they wouldn't, it's just euphemizing in order to hide it. Just sort of smoke. They wouldn't call it conversion. They wouldn't accept that characterization of it. They would say it's
right.
Talking
exploratory therapy.
Yeah,
is
it's
the
exploratory.
Euphemism.
Right, okay.
But obviously the problem is with all of this stuff is it starts from a position of being a trans adult, being sort of a not a desirable outcome.
Yeah.
So it's never neutral. I had therapy was part of my appointments at the gender identity clinic. Like that isn't, it's not something that doesn't exist already. But yeah, what is being advocated for in the CAS report and a lot of other places more recently is this, it is conversion therapy dressed up in other kinds of language.
It comes down to that fundamental belief that when, how, and whether somebody transitions should not be up to them. I'm glad you mentioned conversion therapy, though, because there's an ongoing effort by conversion therapists to get ahead of a ban by rebranding as exploratory therapy, gender exploratory therapy, which is just conversion therapy. That's not just my opinion. That's also the opinion of some medical professionals who've also already condemned the CAS review for this very reason.
The specific place that trans people were not included is the review board. So the group of people that decided what was going to happen, you know, input into their final report. She certainly did talk to lots of trans people, and I think probably mostly young people.
Some of whom have since come forward and condemned the report for misrepresenting their words.
Yeah. But it was the exclusion, which I think was a decision by NHS England. It was them that barred trans people from being part of the review board, but allowed people who have like stated gender critical, aka anti-trans bias views, to be part of it. And I sort of still a question what Hilary Cass's sort of personal view is, because, you know, she's come out since the report was published seemingly quite upset genuinely about what she would call was mischaracterization. She latched onto this idea that people are saying that 98% of studies were excluded, and that absolutely was not the case. And like, okay, technically that is one criticism that has been made that is not technically true. She did find that like 98% didn't meet the criteria for being the kind of study that is the best kind of study, but they still considered some of them. But all this other stuff about the criticism and about the lack of awareness, a lack of acknowledgement of the context in which this report is existing in this country, I just find absolutely baffling. Like, is she the most naive person on planet Earth? She says that she understands the criticism because she thinks that, you know, trans people and our allies are worried about this being weaponized. Like,
justifiably so, I think. What?
Yeah. No, we're not worried about it being weaponized. It is being weaponized.
What's the purpose
what
of it?
What are you talking about? Yeah, I...
She's given multiple contradictory interviews since it came out. Some saying, oh, we should have more gender-affirming care, and some statements in which she appears to support conversion therapy. I think we need to understand those comments. I think we need to understand the contents of the review and also the things that the review excludes, like the fact that NHS England has been condemned multiple times over the last several years by international medical authorities for the way it treats or fails to treat trans people. I think we need to understand all of that in the context of what the Cass review is. It exists to A, justify the direction of travel that the NHS has been going in for the last 10 years, and secondly, to justify what they're attempting to do in future, which is further restrict trans healthcare.
I read a piece in the New York Times, which was a conversation with Dr. Cass. She says, young people growing up now have a much more flexible view about gender. They're not locked into gender stereotypes in the way my generation was. And then she says, that's great, and they can break it down. It only becomes a challenge if we're medicalizing it, giving an irreversible treatment for what might be just a normal range of gender expression. It's like, I'm sorry, that's a really weird analysis. To say that young people now are free from gender stereotypes, and then to imply that that makes them more likely to be trans and to want to become to conform to gender stereotypes, because like what she's saying is that if a young girl is masculine or butch, like she's going to be more like, she's going to think that she has to be a man. That's not being free from gender stereotypes. Mm-hmm. That's the opposite. Like that's the old view of what trans people were and trans people thought they had to be. If you were a butch woman,
you were required to be.
Well, absolutely.
If you wanted permission to transition.
Exactly. You couldn't be a gay trans man like I am, for example. You had to sort of conform to all the gender stereotypes. So if young people understand that they're not beholden to those anymore, wouldn't they be less likely to decide that they're trans incorrectly? Like they might be trans and then we need to listen to them and act. I just think her logic is just completely flawed, like internal. Which, yeah, that to me, aside from all the other kind of stuff, I just thought this person is, doesn't know what she's talking about.
Affect rather than fact. It's about going, oh, I'm a responsible person. I've like done the right thing. It's definitely not our fault that all those patients died. Like, please don't have an inquiry like the infected blood scandal. Like, please don't ever do that. Like, we've all done the responsible, like, scientific thing here. Please don't listen to all the trans people who say that, like, we've been ignoring them and, like, twisting their words and stuff. Just please don't look at that. Please continue thinking of us as, like, responsible, evidence-led people.
Do you take heart from polling data that suggests specifically on that issue that actually 60% of the people polled from the British public did think it was a good idea to teach children about gender identity? I know we're in a terrible moment in terms of our cultural conversation on this issue, but do you take any heart from polling data that suggests that actually outside of the media conversation and the political conversation, that wider society's attitudes are changing and shifting?
Well, they've always been quite positive. I think they've always been around there, and it might have been affected in recent years by the level of vitriol that we see aimed at trans people. But yeah, I still think, despite all of this, I think this is an aberration. And obviously it's become a bit meaningless and a cliche now, but these people are on the wrong side of history. And it's only a matter of time before that is borne out. But it doesn't make anything better right now and doesn't excuse anything that's happening. And I can't see a path to where we get to a system that's like informed consent and self-determination. But I do believe that we will get there eventually. because of everything that's happening, well, I just wish we would stop having conversations about trans people at all.
I think we're a few years off having this, but I hope I'll see it in my lifetime. I'd like to have conversations about who's going to resign over this. I'd like to have conversations about apologies and public memorials and damages. I would like to see public inquiries led by majority trans people investigating this. And I would like to see conversations about trans justice, actually. Mm. I would like to see the people responsible for the deaths in our community forced to stand up and admit that they were wrong. And that won't ever bring back the people who died or the tens of thousands of people who've been denied healthcare for no good reason. But I would like to see justice done. I think it's about more than just saying, oh, you know, 2030, we got like an informed consent system now. Great. It's like, great, that's wonderful. And by the way, we need to be asking these people these questions. So I look forward to that.
Between the infected blood scandal, the post office scandal, sometimes I do sympathise with people that lose their faith in politics and because there's been a corrosion of trust in institutions. And for people like me who still believe in the power of democratic institutions to affect change in a positive way, I really feel like part of rebuilding that trust is accountability.
To be honest, like even sitting here talking about this sort of feels like a tiny, 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 tiny step in the right direction. Because I'm just like, well, that had never occurred to me before that we could maybe one day call for that and demand that. And if we can be part of like shifting the framing of all this in people's minds, like people who listen to this or. Obviously, it needs to happen much more widely. But, you know, yeah, you hear on the radio people sort of saying, oh, do you ever think this could happen again in the NHS, talking about the infected blood scandal? And you're like, well, it's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Like, it's happening right now to trans people. So, yeah, I absolutely do. You know, but that's, you can't imagine a world where that is framed in that way by, e.g., the BBC. But having an opportunity to do it here, you know, yeah, I feel like hopefully this is a positive thing to have done. I mean, there are so many things that we as trans people and the trans community more broadly have to teach wider society about gender and about equality. I am really frustrated often by the fact that we don't get a platform to do that. And we, you know, we're treated as this other thing that is just completely sectioned off and it's all about our problems and it's all about, and we have to come out and do a lot of debunking. Like most, you know, that is mostly what we've done here. No offense, you know, but that's just the way it is. It's like, you know, we have to come out and we have to correct and we can't ever add anything new to the conversation. And actually, there are so many things that we have to say and understand about gender, given our personal experiences and our expertise as like academics and lawyers and whatever, that could like massively help society more broadly. Yeah, and all it is at the moment is that we're being sort of completely demonized. And that's really sad for humanity. Not to sound too grand, but yeah.
Let's talk about something more positive then. As you know, we have a section on this show, Heroes and Villains. Have you had a think about any heroes you'd like to highlight?
I would like to highlight, not by name, obviously, but all the people who creatively misdirect hormones in order to allow trans people to have control over our own bodies. All those anonymous people who enable us to do our own thing and go our own way. Those people are my fucking heroes.
I would like to highlight I think the perception is that there aren't sort of trans specific organizations out there. And obviously there are for trans young people, but there are also two smaller organizations that I don't think get enough attention. One is the Trans Safety Network, which is a research collective of experts that are just constantly working away without any fanfare or attention and churning out these incredibly well-researched, thorough documents. So Trans Safety Network, you should check out. If anything ever comes up in the news and you're like, that sounds a bit maybe not true, you know, Google what the Trans Safety Network has said about it. And also Trans Actual, which are doing great work behind the scenes. And their briefing on the CAS review, I think, is the single most important document out there at the moment. If anyone wants to understand the criticisms and why the criticisms are important and not just a kind of throwing the toys out of the pram by the trans community, in case that's what people might think, that document is essential.
We will provide links to all of those in the show notes. he says confidently, despite not knowing how that happens.
Someone will do that.
Someone who understands how to do this will have put links to all of those organisations in the show notes.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you coming on the show. It's a subject that we agonise about whether we should talk about, because I sort of feel queasy about the fact that we've had this conversation to begin with,
because I feel
uncomfortable about the idea of bringing people onto a show and forcing you essentially to defend your identity and who you are. And in the end, I think one of the things that pushed us over the top is this idea that they're suppressing these conversations in school, and suppressing those conversations is not good for anybody. Mm. It doesn't help. But really, I would have liked to talk to you about Star Wars for an hour.
Yeah. So you'll get your chance. Star Wars and more. Yeah, if you think, like, if Star Wars fans are upset about me being in that, wait till you hear the next
thing. Did you get to wear a suit?
A suit?
You know, they're like the famous Star Wars suits.
I can't tell you what I wore. Well, actually, I'm in the trailer, so you can see what I wore.
Okay.
I'm in the new trailer. You can see what I'm wearing.
Are you talking about Star Trek?
I don't know what I'm talking about. I think that's the honest to God truth.
Right.
Do you mean like the red suits with the buttons?
You're talking about Star Trek.
That's Star Trek.
Have you just sat here thinking we've been talking about Star Trek?
Star Wars is the one with the Force.
And the Yoda.
Yes.
And the Yoda. Yoda.
I believe
Yoda.
That's what he's called, isn't it? Yeah. The Yoda.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Yoda,
yeah.
Great. Anyway, cool.
Well, unbelievably, that's the end of the show. What a way to wrap it up. Abigail and Freddie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure.
Thank you.
Now, if you have any heroes that you want to shout out, or any other comments you want to share or topics you want us to look into, you can send us an email. The address is psuk@reducedlistening.co.uk. We also really love to hear your voices. So if you're feeling brave and want to ask us a question, send us a voice note on WhatsApp. Our number is 07494 933 444. Internationally, that's +44 7494 933 444.
Don't forget to follow @PodSaveTheUK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter. You can also find us on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. You can also drop us a review if you like.
Pod Save the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer James Tyndale and digital producer Alex Bishop.
Video editing was by Dan Hodgson and the music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Thanks to our engineer, Alex Bennett.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma, Dan Jackson and Madeline Herringer, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
Remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.